This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, we're joined by a representative of the U.S. Small Business Administration to find out more about the low-interest economic injury disaster loans that are available to small businesses and nonprofits that have been economically impacted by the red tide bloom that's persisted off the coast of Southwest Florida since the end of last year. But first, Ray Judah was a Lee County Commissioner from 1988 to 2012. During that time, Judah was a staunch advocate for environmental issues, including being instrumental in the creation of the county's land preservation program called Conservation 2020. Since leaving office, he has continued to champion environmental issues as a citizen. He joins us today to discuss the many aspects of the water woes currently impacting Southwest Florida, including the toxic blue-green algae bloom in the Caloosahatchee River and estuary, and the aforementioned red tide bloom along the coast. We caught up with Mr. Judah earlier today, so this first segment is pre-taped and we're not taking calls, but if you'd like to make a comment on our conversation, find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So you served as Lee County Commissioner for 24 years, correct?
I did, from 1988 to 2012.
What have you been up to since?
Well, after I was ousted from office in 2012, the Florida Coastal and Ocean Coalition, a consortium of a number of environmental organizations, hired me on as their executive director. I served in that capacity for 2.5 years and then ultimately decided that I wanted to phase out from that responsibility and help out a good friend of mine run for county commissioner, Dick Anderson, back in 2016. I helped a lot of candidates in their quest for public office and try to provide as much insight as I can to assist their efforts.
And water issues have been something that have always been big on your agenda, even back when you were a commissioner, right? This is something as I looked, you know, I remember talking to you during the years I was here prior when you were a commissioner, but I went back and was reading some of your op-eds and whatnot over the years, and you've been beating this drum for a long time.
You know, Mike, I really have. I mean, when you consider that the Caloosahatchee is the heart and soul of our environment, our economy here in Lee County. Just as Lake Okeechobee is the heart of the waterways for the state of Florida, recognizing how important our waterways are for our real estate industry, tourism industry, our recreational opportunities. Yeah, it's been first and foremost a concern for me, and I have written a lot of op-eds, tried to provide the necessary information for the public to decide on what is the solution to all the challenges that we're currently having to deal with.
You are co-founder of the Corkscrew Regional Ecosystem Watershed and helped make Conservation 2020, which is the land preservation program, a reality. Can you remind listeners what those two things are? And then let's talk a little bit about how they're doing.
Sure. CREW, the Conservation Regional Ecosystem Watershed, was a trust that we set up back in, oh gosh, it was 1989, Mike.
Wow.
This really takes me back a ways just to jog my memory. What the county commission did, and I supported it, we raised the millage 0.3 of a mil to generate about $8.5 million for 3 years. And in fact, we were able to match that money with the Save Our Rivers program with the South Florida Water Management District. We were able to acquire a considerable amount of land in the southeastern part of Lee County to protect the two most productive aquifers, the Tamiami and Sandstone aquifers, and of course all the wetlands in the area. And it really has proven to be a very successful program in conjunction with the South Florida Water Management District. Conservation 2020, likewise, was a huge success. That was an issue that went on the ballot in 1996. The people voted to tax themselves, and it went into effect right after it was approved by the voters in 96. Lee County has purchased some over 300 parcels. We have indeed, by having the Conservation 2020 and the Corkscrew Regional Ecosystem Watershed Land Trust Program, been able to protect our natural legacy, been able to protect our water supplies, to help alleviate flooding, to actually increase value to surrounding properties, to provide open space for public recreation and for wildlife. So it's been a huge success, and I really think that that is what has allowed Lee County to be distinct from other communities, because this was done locally for the most part, where in which we were able to protect our public open spaces.
How is Conservation 2020 doing these days? We did a show not too long ago about Florida Forever, and we did talk some about Conservation 2020. Is it still funded and moving forward?
You know, unfortunately, Mike, when I was ousted from office in 2012, the majority of the board decided that they instead wanted to use that money that previously had been designated for not only purchase but management of environmentally sensitive lands, again, to protect our water resources and public recreational lands, and instead use that money to balance the budget. So in my estimation and my understanding, I felt the Board of County Commissioners after 2012 violated the public trust, because it was the people of Lee County that voted to tax themselves to spend that money on purchase and management of environmentally sensitive lands. And the Board of County Commissioners at that time decided that they wanted to instead use that money to balance the budget. Well, a number of years later, in fact, I think it was 2016, the people of Lee County voted to re-up the Conservation 2020 program. In fact, I believe it was like 84% of the people in Lee County voted to support funding that program. But again, other than the purchase of Edison Farms, the Board of County Commissioners has been reluctant to use that money for its intended purpose and instead has basically eliminated the actual designated line item on the budget spreadsheet, and instead have basically folded that millage rate into the general fund. So it's really a very disingenuous act on the Board of County Commissioners because that money is no longer designated as it was solely for purchase of environmentally sensitive lands to protect our water resources and public open spaces.
You were commissioner here for a long time. You presumably lived here for a while before that, so you've been a Southwest Floridian for decades. Have you ever seen it like we're seeing it now with the confluence of the blue-green and the red tide and the year-round now? It's basically almost a year-old red tide.
No, this is we're over the tipping point now, Mike. It's just really heartbreaking to see what's going on, not only with the extensive amount of toxic blue-green algae in our freshwater canals and the Coosa River, but the increase in frequency and duration and the magnitude of the red tide that we're experiencing off our shores. And, you know, it brings to light a point that needs to be made, because unfortunately even the media doesn't quite expand on the fact that while red tide is considered natural, it's a natural phenomena emanating from offshore, but when it works its way inshore via either wave or wind action, it really manifests itself because of the nutrients that are in the nearshore area. And of course, that's land-based nutrient primarily from the sugarcane fields back pumping into Lake Okeechobee down the Coosahatchie, depositing those nutrients in our nearshore water areas, which magnify the extent of the red tide problems that we're experiencing.
Do you feel like really almost epic nature of these two harmful algal blooms and the way public perception, you know, with Facebook now, everybody's seeing the dead animals and things like that. Do you think that there is a chance for political will at a higher level than has been in the past? We've had people on who are not liberals, who are not people who would have ever voted green, who are raising the banner saying we have to fix this, which is sort of an interesting combination of things right now.
You know, I'd like to believe that people are now starting to understand the connection between those that are supposed to represent us and wishing to actually provide meaningful solutions to solving issues and problems like the harmful algae blooms that are plaguing our coastal areas. But unfortunately, what I'm still seeing are people voting for the very representatives that have gutted and eviscerated the policies and environmental regulations that years ago were set in place to protect our environment. So for some reason, the voters have not seemed to connect the dots. And once they do, and once they start voting and putting people in office that are in tune with issues as opposed to party politics, I'm concerned that we're going to continue to see the demise of our natural resources. So people have somehow got to be better educated and understand that it's not a political party issue. It's, do you want clean water? Do you want a healthy environment in which you can raise your children? Do you want a strong tourism economy that's the backbone of our economic base here in Lee County? And then start understanding and voting for those candidates that are like-minded, that also want to clean up our waterways, restore our rivers and our estuaries.
The governor's office just announced this morning it was sort of their latest in their stream of funding for this issue now that I guess Governor Scott is running for Senate. $2.2 million investment to expand Moat Marine Laboratory's ozone system testing and their clay testing. Now, my first question is what do you think of all this money that's coming out of Tallahassee, which seems to me to be political because this is not an issue that the governor's office has taken up very strongly until suddenly recently.
You know, there's no question it is political, Mike. When you think about Rick Scott has been disastrous to the state of Florida. I'm a registered Republican, but I got to tell you, first of all, in 2010 when he took office, he had no interest in looking at exercising the options that had been taken out at the time of the Charlie Crist administration and the state of Florida with the concurrence and approval of U.S. Sugar to purchase all, if not some, of the land that's needed for storage and treatment of water south of Lake Okeechobee to alleviate the damages to our estuaries. And Rick Scott had no interest at all, in fact, refused to even consider purchase of any land south of the lake. He has also been behind approving legislation that has been detrimental to cleaning up our waterways. For instance, the 2016 so-called water bill that Adam Putnam's agricultural office drafted and currently Representative Matt Caldwell, who's now running for Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services, sponsored the bill that essentially eliminated any real meaningful opportunities to clean our waterways from Apalachicola to the Keys. And I say that because what they basically have done is to – through that water bill was to supplant the regulatory permitting approach with a volunteer best management practices approach. And obviously that's not getting us to the point where we need to be to hold the polluters accountable. And so I would submit to you that while it's important that the state is providing some financial relief to the businesses that have been hurt because of the harmful algae blooms, it's ironic that this could all have been avoided to begin with much more cost effectively by having the regulations and policies in place to protect our waterways. And unfortunately, that didn't happen.
The other thing that they've announced, I think it was a week and a half ago, is that they Governor Scott sent a letter to the Florida Wildlife Conservation Commission asking it to create a Center for Red Tide Research and to reinstate the Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force. What are your thoughts on, first of all, the do we need another Center for Red Tide Research? I suppose it couldn't hurt, but I think there's already some research going on.
There's a tremendous amount of research going on. And in fact, I remember over a decade ago when Lee County ended up hiring Dr. Larry Brand from the University of Miami Rosenthal School of Sciences to determine the best way to address nutrient runoff from the lake and to actually identify whether or not it's the nutrients from the lake that are causing or the precursors to the outbreak of red tide. And in fact, Larry Brand was able to prove that. So the research is there. We already know what's causing the problem. But Scott, Caldwell, Putnam, they disregard the science and instead end up actually acquiescing to the moneymakers, the lobbyists, the corporations, and in this case, Big Sugar, who have provided the funding for their campaigns over the years, and instead are not actually representing the public trust.
Let's talk a little bit about Big Sugar. U.S. Sugar CEO Robert Bucher had an op-ed in the News Press a few weeks ago. His main point is, and this is something that we've heard, and I want to see what your take is on it, that the amount of back pumping that's happening these days is less than 1% of the water that goes into Lake Okeechobee. Do you know the accuracy of that, and do you know what it means? I mean, compared to past years, can we kind of flesh out what you know about that?
Mike, that comment from Bucher doesn't even pass the straight face test. I can tell you for years, for decades, in fact, we have what's called legacy or residual nutrients
Let's start with what's happening right now.
But the point I'm trying to make is because of the residual legacy nutrients in the lake, every time we get major storm events or hurricanes in the summer, all the nutrients get distributed into the water column, and then are flushed down either the St. Lucie on the East Coast or the Coosa-Hatchee on the West Coast. So that's an issue in and of itself. But the back pumping is still going on. Now, I remember being at a South Florida Water Management District Governing Board meeting when Charlie Crist, then governor's appointees, stopped the back pumping for water supply purposes. Because back pumping used to be allowed for water supply, which meant that the water was pumped into the lake during the heavy wet rainy season so that it would be available for the sugar industry and in the Everglades agriculture area, that 700,000 acre vast expanse of land south of the lake in the summer when they were going through drought conditions. So it was not only back pump into the lake for water supply but also for flood control. And Bucher suggests that the reason that the water is now back pumped, which is no longer allowed for water supply but is allowed for flood control, is to protect the coastal communities, you know, like South Bay and Pahokee and Belglade.
Coastal meaning on the edge of the lake.
Lake Okeechobee communities. I apologize. Like South Bay and Belglade and Pahokee, that it's to protect those communities from being flooded. And that's really disingenuous because – really, when you consider that the Everglades agricultural is over 700,000 acres in size and those communities, the lakeside communities, are so small footprint-wise and they are at higher ground, the back pumping for flooding is actually a justification or excuse for the sugar industry to benefit from that water being back pumped into the lake during the wet rainy season in order to have optimum growing conditions for their sugarcane. And I would submit to you, Mike, the South Florida Water Management District actually manages the water level in the Everglades agricultural area at 18 to 24 inches below ground, regardless of seasonal fluctuation, to provide optimum growing conditions for sugarcane. Since the sugar industry cannot meet the federal consent decree, the 1989 federal consent decree that stipulated that phosphorus could not exceed 10 parts per billion as it were to be released into the Everglades, they have no other place to put it. They can't release it to the Everglades because they can't meet the 10 parts per billion. So they end up having the South Florida Water Management District back pump that water back up into the lake. And of course, from there, it goes down the Coosa-Hatchee and the St. Lucie into our coastal estuaries.
I am speaking with former Lee County Commissioner Ray Judah on today's show. This segment is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls. But if you'd like to make a question or ask a question, rather, or make a comment, go to our Facebook page, WGCU Public Media, or find us on Twitter at WGCU. First of all, I do want to say that we have invited Mr. Bucher on Gulf Coast Live. I have had an email conversation and a phone conversation with his personal assistant, so we're working on that. But I just want to go back to the legacy nutrients in the lake. We had Dr. Mike Parsons from FGCU, who's done a lot of research into this stuff, on, and he said, you know, yes, the stuff that's in there will not break down and turn into some other form that is no longer a nutrient. Is it possible that we just have so much in there from pumping over the years that no matter what we do now, it's going to cause problems when it goes east and west if it's been stirred up from the bottom?
You know, I'd like to be optimistic, Mike. And I remember a number of years ago when we were experiencing quite a drought and the waters had receded within the lake. So it allowed the South Florida Water Management.
Yeah, they trucked a bunch out.
They
did.
You're right. You're absolutely right. They actually were able to get heavy equipment in there and scoop up a lot of the muck. With heavy equipment, as you said, but they ended up depositing that muck on the inside of the dike because there was so much recession of water that there was a lot of land area where they could – they had no other place to dump but well, interestingly enough, when they sampled that they had scooped up and collected and stockpiled, there was a tremendous high concentration of arsenic. And so therein lied the problem of
– Now they can't just put it anywhere.
Exactly. Mm. So I would still submit though, Mike, that somehow there's got to be a way, whether you wait for dry conditions to get heavy equipment in there or you use some kind of suction dredge to be able to try to remove the sediment or the muck layer that has all the nutrients and toxic brew of insecticides and fungicides and pesticides that have built up over the years to try to remove it and clean up the lake.
So in other words, yes, no matter what we do, there's going to be a risk for that coming down the estuaries in the wrong confluence of meteorological conditions because
yes.
of the hurricane. Because the last time we had this big algae bloom, especially on – it was the other coast that got it last time. That was the year after a hurricane. So it seems like there might be some connection.
There absolutely is a connection.
Recently, the South Florida Water Management District announced that they're going to slightly – well, by 25%, they're going to change the amount of water that is released from Lake Okeechobee during the minimum flow time. So right now we're at a maximum flow. They're having to release extra water. Do you know anything about the changing the minimum flow from 300 cubic feet per second to 400?
Well, that would be a positive step in the right direction.
Okay.
Because when you consider that it was the district that set up the guidelines that for the appropriate flow from, for instance, the lake into the river and then out into our estuaries, we would need at least 600 to 2,800 cubic feet per second. In other words, 600 at least minimum flows, 2,800 maximum flows. And as I read the other day, we're already at 4,200 cubic feet per second.
Yeah, right.
We're experiencing harm, you know, as we speak. And the South Florida Water and Management District has continually exceeded and violated its own guidelines. So that the times where we need minimum flow, if the district can at least provide a greater than 300 to 400, perhaps even 600, get it up to that 600 CFS cubic feet per second level, then during those dry times of the year, that would really help our estuaries.
And that's something that, you know, I'm actually trying to put together a show where we can go in and explore. You know, right now we're in wet season. We've got the harmful algal blooms. People have such a short attention span that I'm trying to remind listeners that sometimes we have the exact opposite problem where there's not enough water to go around and there's ecosystems that are being threatened by that. So anyway, just want to remind listeners that there's more than one side to this coin, obviously. I also wanted to ask you, the Water Management District is now testing what it's calling emergency estuary protection wells, which are basically deep water injection wells that put water 3,500, 4,000 feet down below everything to the boulder zone, they call it. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely disastrous, Mike. And here's the problem. You know, I think they used to call it aquifer storage recovery, where they would take excess water during the wet, rainy summer
right.
months and inject it down into the aquifer or the deep.
That's less deep, though, right?
Well,
those are the ones they can bring the water back.
Well, but the problem they've had, and they tested it, is there was no certainty on the percentage of recovery, and
gotcha.
So they decided that's too risky,
right.
especially at $6
to
$10
million. Because they don't
know where it's going. Exactly. And the other problem, and this is the big problem, Mike. Of course, the South Florida Water Management District is talking about deep well injection. Never mind trying to recover it;
just send it down to
the boulder zone, as you had mentioned. But I got to tell you, I think they've renamed it. What'd you say, estuaries protection?
Emergency estuary protection wells.
Yeah, what a play on people's senses from the standpoint that they're giving everybody the impression they're really concerned about the estuaries, but they're really not, because here's the critical point, Mike. We need water in the system, and it takes water out of the system if you deep well inject that water. The Everglades is starving for water. They need clean water, but they need water. Florida Bay is too saline. It needs fresh water. Because of sea level rise, which is actually occurring no matter how people think it's and why it's occurring. It's occurring, as you well know. City of Miami is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on backflow preventers and pumps, you know, because of the and elevating their roads and their buildings. So if you can get fresh water flowing back to the southern end of the state, you're going to end up recharging the Biscayne Aquifer. You're going to end up re-nourishing the Everglades. You're going to provide the appropriate balance of fresh and salt water in Florida Bay and bring back the fisheries in Florida Bay. And you're going to push back saltwater intrusion, protecting the well fields. So there's all the reason in the world why we need to restore flow to the south, not take water out of the system and inject it deep into the earth below the 3,000-foot boulder zone.
Remind us, let's go back now to the 2010 time frame when there was a deal to buy land from U.S. Sugar that was put together under Governor Crist, and then Governor Scott came in. Was that a decision by Governor Scott for just whatever reason he had, or was there something connected to the land value? Because I was thinking of the timing. That was right after the crash. It seems to me maybe it seemed like a great idea for U.S. Sugar. They're like, whoa, wow, somebody's going to buy all our land. It's not worth anything. And then they maybe changed their mind. Or do you know anything about
that? Yeah, I can tell you the entire 184,000 acres in the inventory of including the refineries and the railroad track and all the land.
That was all on the table.
That was all on the table. And Charlie Crist worked out a great deal for the state of Florida from the standpoint that he got locked in $7,400 an acre. Well, when Scott came in, there were measurable points over the course of the time frame with regards to exercising the option. Initially, it was to purchase 184,000 acres. That got reduced to 76,000 acres. Ultimately, when Governor Chris left office and Governor Scott came in office, the state had acquired 26,000 acres. And they used that land to do some exchanges with other land that I think it was not only U.S. Sugar but Florida Crystals owned. So we really lost a tremendous opportunity because the Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Sciences, the University of Florida Water Institute have all recommended the need to buy additional land south of the lake for more storage and treatment and releasing that water to the Everglades.
And I was reading an op-ed. You said somewhere in the order of 50,000 acres is what some people are saying would be required to make that possible. Is that about right?
That is correct. And that's the minimal amount, Mike, but it would make a huge difference. And to be more specific, we're talking 50,000 acres, 20,000 from U.S. Sugar, 30,000 from Florida Crystals, the other big sugar owner in the Everglades agricultural area. The land would actually be between North New River Canal and the Miami Canal because there's five major canals that were built back in the 1940s to help drain the Everglades. And it would be adjacent to 62,000 acres of already publicly owned land. So
those are the
Rodenburg Tract and the Holy Lands.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you could connect this 50,000 acres to the 62,000 acres of publicly owned land. You have a 100,000 acre plus footprint where in which you could have a kind of like a chain of lakes, Mike, where you'd have shallow water reservoirs and wetland marshes, so you could actually store and treat the water to the standard within which it could ultimately flow into the Everglades.
Is that could that happen alongside of continued sugar farming? Is there
Absolutely.
Geographically, like if you look at a map, there's a way to do this, and so it's everybody still has a
And thanks for bringing that point up, Mike, because the sugar industry will say, well, you're trying to destroy the sugar industry's business and put people out of work, and that's not the case. And we're not talking about eliminating refineries or impacting homes. We're talking about 50,000 acres of sugarcane fields. And yes, there's a total of 440,000 acre plus of sugarcane fields in the Everglades agricultural area. So we're talking about actually, 11%. 7% of the sugarcane inventory and 11% of the entire Everglades agriculture, which also has row crops in addition to sugarcane, that's needed to be able to restore the Everglades and to and the adverse impacts to the coastal estuaries because of the nutrient overloading discharge down the rivers and still have a viable sugarcane industry. It's a wonderful balance. It's the best of all worlds, but the sugarcane industry is not interested coming to the table and giving up or selling one square centimeter of existing sugarcane fields. And it's unfortunate because they could still have a viable industry. And in fact, we could actually end up diversifying and strengthening the economy in these communities around Lake Okeechobee with promoting ecotourism, just like we have the benefits we have here in Lee County. So
Let's talk a little bit about CERP, Comprehensive
Sure.
Everglades Restoration Plan, passed by Congress in
2000.
Okay, I knew it was early 2000s. What do you know about the progress that's been made? I know there's been a lot. There's a lot that's been done. There's a lot that's still being done. They're building the C-43 reservoir out near Alva, and that's actually like it's being built. What are your thoughts on where CERP stands and what it said it was going to do versus where we are?
Well, let me first of all let you know and your listeners know that CERP is deeply flawed. And it's unfortunate because that is the program or the plan that all our politicians fall back on that we need to implement in order to restore the Everglades and eliminate the adverse impacts to the coastal estuaries. And I'll tell you why it's flawed. The Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Program was based on a central South Florida flood control model. Like anything, a business plan, you always need to do some type of model to make sure it's viable, right? Well, the South Florida Water Management District based their data in terms of average rainfall to determine the extent of the reservoirs and how much water needed to be stored on this central South Florida flood control model. And the period of record, Mike, that they used was 1965 to 1995. Interestingly enough, if you look at the NOAA's, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, meteorological data, you will see that 25 of those 30 years were below average rainfall. So they have truly underestimated the amount of storage that's needed to handle the excessive releases of polluted water from Lake Okeechobee. And therein lies the problem. It all gets discharged down to our coastal estuaries. The reservoirs that are to be built will not be sufficient to handle the excess releases of polluted water. The C43 reservoir that you talked about that's under construction, that will store about 55 billion gallons of water, 170,000 acre-feet of water. C44, which is already built on the East Coast, does not take water from the lake. It takes water from the surrounding agricultural fields. The Everglades reservoir that's to be built with under the Senate Bill 10, Negron's bill, where it was going to provide funding to build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades agricultural area on existing publicly owned lands, which right now, by the way, has been currently leased to the sugar industry and should have been – that lease should have ended decades ago, where in which that land was needed for storage and treatment. But if you tie in all those reservoirs under SERP, we're still a million acre-feet short. That's 325 billion gallons of water short of what is needed to store that excess of releases from the lake, which means our coastal estuaries are going to continue to get hammered until we get more land purchased south of the lake for storage and treatment.
But what they're doing at least is progress toward something. It may not be that when they complete everything they have on the list for SERP, it will solve the problem, but at least something's being done. I mean, is it at least forward progress?
It's forward progress with regards to the Everglades agricultural area reservoir that you're talking about. It's going to maybe store 65 billion gallons of water. You add the 55 billion gallons of water under the C43 reservoir. That's 130 billion gallons of water. You're not even halfway there in terms of what's needed to handle the excessive polluted discharges. In other words, the C43 reservoir is only going to store about 55 billion gallons of water, as I said. And during the heavy, wet, rainy summer months, we get 500 billion gallons of water discharged from the lake down the Clusatch River. So it's only going to handle 10%.
And I'm wondering if in – like right now, how do you keep blue-green algae from taking over the reservoir?
Well, that's a very good point. And I've written several commentaries that what actually the South Florida Water Management District will be doing is building an incubator for blue-green algae, because when you consider that reservoir, it's going to be about 22 feet built above ground. Okay, it's going to be primarily cement. It's not even available for public recreational use because of the volatility of the level of the water within that reservoir. But you consider it has nutrients. That because the water – there's going to be water intake from the Clusatchee that then routes that water into the reservoir. So you got the nutrients that are coming down from the lake. You've got warm weather and you have no mixing. That actually will be ideal conditions as an incubator for the growth of blue-green algae. And quite frankly, Mike, I think what we're going to have here is a billion-dollar reservoir where because of the Clean Water Act, that water cannot be re-released back into the Clusatchee River because of the blue-green algae.
Well, let me stop there for a second. The Clean Water Act. Why does the Clean Water Act not apply to water coming out of the lake or for water going back into the lake from wherever? I mean, as I understand it, the Clean Water Act says you can't move polluted water from one navigable body or whatever to another, period. How is all this water being moved around?
It's a really valid point, and there's been a lot of lawsuits about the transfer of water from one source to another source. But for whatever reason, there doesn't seem to be any resolution because quite frankly, it's the state that has jurisdiction over water quality. But the Clean Water Act does come into play.
So the state gets to choose whether to apply it. It doesn't have to abide by it.
That seems to be the case because they certainly aren't abiding by it. And that's what really is to me the most incredible situation that people don't seem to come to realize. You know, they look at the federal government and the Corps of Engineers as the ones that are causing the problem with regards to the release of this water from Lake Okeechobee. The Corps of Engineers has no choice. You know, public safety has to trump everything.
Right.
And so with no relief valve – by the way, there's relief valves in terms of a spillway in all other dams and reservoirs throughout the world, but Lake Okeechobee. The Corps relies on the Clusahatchee and the St. Lucie as their relief valves.
They are the relief valves.
And that shouldn't be the case. But nonetheless, in order to protect the integrity of the dike and prevent flooding and impacts on property and people, they have to release water at certain stages. But it's the state that has jurisdiction over water quality, and they have failed miserably in terms of their responsibility.
Let's talk we only have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about some other sources of pollution that are talked about. leaky septic tanks, stormwater runoff from urban fertilizer use, farms north of the lake, cow farms, agricultural farms, you know, all kinds of things that are also adding to this equation. How can we address those, and where do those fit into the big puzzle for you?
Well, I was pleased to help champion the fertilizer ordinance that Lee County has. And unfortunately, the state has not provided any leadership in terms of providing a meaningful statewide fertilizer ordinance. It's up to the individual counties to actually enact their own local ordinances.
We just did a show on that. And unfortunately, there's no enforcement though. So,
Well, there better be in Lee County. If there's not, then shame on Lee County.
Well, I mean there is, but it's not like there's people driving around testing. It's kind of like if your neighbor calls.
And good point, Mike. And they should be. There should be. But nonetheless, the ordinance is on the books and it should be enforced. But I got to tell you, you know, there was a representative of Maychek a number of years ago who suggested that Lee County should clean up its own backyard before they start talking about Lake Okeechobee. And he was blaming the wastewater treatment plants. So I went ahead and did a little research on the wastewater treatment plants. There's five of them that discharge into the Clusatch River in Lee County. Nitrogen is the limiting nutrient, which means that we have a lot of phosphorus background in our waters in Lee County. But if you get a lot of nitrogen, you get the right ratio of nitrogen and phosphorus. That's what creates the problem with red tide and blue green algae. So the problem is the nitrogen that's coming down from Lake Okeechobee. But as I said, I did analysis on the five water treatment plants, and it came out to where 260 pounds per day of total nitrogen was released into the Clusatchee River. It's 24,000 pounds a day of total nitrogen east of the Franklin Locks, and that's primarily coming from Lake Okeechobee. So yeah, we need to clean up with regards to having our fertilizer ordinance in force, converting septic tanks to wastewater treatment plants. But the main culprit, the main source of the nutrients that are affecting coastal communities with regards to blue-green algae and red tide is the excessive amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that is being backpumped from the sugarcane fields into Lake Okeechobee under the auspices of flood control. And Mike, there's no numeric nutrient criteria or enforcement for all that water, that toxic brew that is backpumped from the Everglades agricultural area into the lake.
Do people – I mean scientists, is there testing being done with what's coming down the Kissimmee as it enters the lake of these levels? Is there testing being done on site of what's coming from south of the lake back into the lake? It seems like it would be fairly straightforward to be able to test for levels of this water that's entering the lake.
Common sense would dictate that be the case. Rick Scott decided that he wanted to gut the South Florida all the water management districts' budgets by hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 8 years that he's been in office. And much of what he gutted was the monitoring and enforcement programs. So much of what you're talking about with regards to testing, yes, there used to be testing stations. Much of that was eliminated and stopped. So now you have big gaps in data collection. As far as any testing for the back pumping, there is no testing. There's no enforcement. And there's no standards.
Hmm. It just seems like, you know, science has come so far, and there's citizen scientists and there's the waterkeeper people, and there seems like we could be doing that testing even if it wasn't for government. I mean, it seems like it could be done, but maybe not.
No, government should set the example, and they're not. They're walking away from their responsibility.
Real quick before we wrap up here, I just want to talk about some of the things that have been proposed as possible solutions. This George Barley Water Prize, do you know about it? The $10 million that the Everglades Foundation is putting up to have teams compete to try to come up with ways to remove phosphorus from the water. Do you know anything about that?
I do. In fact, Alginol, the company here that's doing the research on algae to ethanol, and they're still doing a lot of research. They actually were willing, and they – interesting enough, Mike, they could use blue-green algae in a controlled environment because it's such a voracious feeder of nutrients. But the South Florida Managed District told Alginol, because it's going to be about $2 million to help set it up, that they would have to front the money. And Alginol said, listen, if you all front the money, we'll provide the expertise and operate this facility. Well, it didn't work out. So the $10 million grant, the Barley grant, sounds great, but I don't know if any of these entities out there actually have the front money to make it happen.
Yeah, there are teams that have been testing up in Canada, and now they're getting ready to do some testing up near Orlando. It'll be interesting to see if they find a solution, if it can actually be scaled up to the level that would do enough difference, you know what I mean? And the last thing I wanted to ask you about is FGCU professor Dr. Bill Mitch. He spent most of his career at Ohio State University. He's down here now. He started on this plan. He has this idea of using land and rotating its use. So in other words, having it be like a stormwater treatment area with, you know, to get the nutrients out of the water, and then after maybe 10 years, draining it and then letting people farm on it, using all that nutrients that have been in the, you know what I mean? So then back to farming. Now it's stormwater. Back to farming. Have you heard of anything like that? It was – I'd never heard –
It makes
that,
like, yes,
that was an out-of-the-box solution I had yet to hear.
Yes, I have, and I think the world of Dr. Bill Mitch, and I think that's a viable solution.
So you think that it sounds like from interviewing him that the biggest challenge would be to get the landowners on board with such an out-of-the-box idea.
Correct.
Last thought. I just want to reflect back. As I was driving in on Treeline, I remembered the day that Treeline was dedicated. And you were there and I was there and some officials were there and we were standing right there where the overpass is now that goes to the airport. And I remember asking you, like, what is this going to look like someday? Because right then it was just this road through trees. And now I drive it every morning and every afternoon and it's just all developed. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on how we're doing in terms of development and growth in Lee County.
Mike, I don't have enough time to let you know my true feelings, but I got to say I'm very disappointed with the current county commission over the last 6 years where they've pretty much eviscerated the Lee County Comprehensive Plan. There's unbridled development. You know, there has to be some reasonable pattern of growth and development so you can provide for cost-effective infrastructure, roads, drainage, to be able to accommodate that development. But right now it's just so haphazard and they've completely, I think in my estimation, compromise what was previously the density reduction groundwater resource area where our critical water supplies are, our potable water.
That's down here around
that
the,
is correct. Yeah. And they've just allowed way too much development with increased frequency and – I mean density and intensity. And it's most unfortunate. You know, we're at what, at about maybe 700,000 people right now and we're looking at doubling the population by the time we had build out. It's scary to think that unless we get a future commission that understands the importance of managing growth, responsible, reasonable development is good for the community, good for the economy. But it's got to be managed, and right now it's not.
All right. That's all the questions I have. Any final thoughts?
No, it's just a pleasure to be with you, Mike.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
That is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Ray Judah, as a former Lee County Commissioner. He served from 1988 to 2012. When we return, the U.S. Small Business Administration is offering low-interest disaster loans to small businesses and nonprofits that have suffered economic losses caused by the red tide bloom along the coast of Southwest Florida. All Southwest Florida counties are covered and eligible. We're joined by an SBA representative to find out more. I'm Mike Canary, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.